Welcome to the Nerd Party.
Hello and welcome to the A24 project here on the Nerd Party Network. Me and Dallas King make our way through the A24 filmography and bring you interviews along the way with the talent involved. And in this episode, we're doing both as we review Zola and we go behind the scenes of the making of the movie with the co-writer and director, Yanisai Bravo. But first, A24 news, and there's been so much news lately, announcements and trailer drops that we could fill an episode, but I'm going to pick three bits to focus on today. And I think the first one that we have to do is keep it kind of local, and that is the Green Knight has been dumped in the UK, and we are not getting it. There's no word on it. It's not even been officially announced that the Green Knight isn't due to come out on the day this episode drops on Friday. I'm still trying to process it, Dallas. Like, even until yesterday when the cinemas started releasing their showtimes for Friday, I thought, surely there's some hope that Green Knight will come to the UK. And no, it's still missing.
It's such a bizarre one. It is. It was like everyone was getting ready for it. You know, we thought we were going to be back to cinemas. You know, even though technically A24 doesn't distribute in the UK, we thought we're going to get an A24 double bill here. I mean, actually, technically, a triple bill, because I believe the Val documentary drops on Amazon Prime on the same day. We were going to get Green Knight, Zola, and then Val. And then, yeah, just Robbie Colm from the Telegraph tweeted, you know, it's been pulled, and everyone like, what? And yeah, it seems it's disappeared. The real reasoning is murky at best. Entertainment Film were claiming that it was due to COVID-related fears about the future of the cinematic landscape at that point. I think it's been proven that that was rather hasty because things seem to be levelling off and there seems to be a bit more optimism about people returning to the cinema in decent enough numbers. I mean, this was a film which was never going to get a huge amount of numbers, although was number two in America behind Jungle Cruise. Whether it will get that kind of level again, because I think now people have seen it, it's maybe Entertainment Film where, I don't know, did they buy it thinking they were getting like a Arthurian, you know, swords and sandals type, you know, blockbuster thing here, and then only when the reviews started dropping in America did they realize they were getting something slightly more, well, David Lowry-esque, I guess. Yeah, it's bizarre to know. There's been rumours that a streaming service have offered them a deal they could not refuse. So whether we see it here on Prime or Netflix or maybe even Mubi, perhaps, I don't know. But yes, very, very sad news, especially with the fact that as this was dropping, the press screenings in America were going ahead and all the critics were dropping the reviews. People have been standing outside the cinema with the Green Knight posters, wearing their super yakky Dev Patel summer t-shirts and stuff like that. And it's just, it's gotten to the point where I don't normally mute things on Twitter, but I feel like I might potentially have to mute the Green Knight. But then when I do, I'll never find out when it actually is releasing in the UK. So
probably the best way, if you want to avoid any sort of news and stories about the Green Knight, is just to mute the word come instead. That seems to be the thing the past few days of, like, the cum scene, and it's like, I don't know.
I didn't know there was one. I'd heard rumours, I have thankfully have avoided any further detail as to that. I mean, I did get the Green Knight role-playing game, but through a brief scan of that, I don't believe there was any mention of that in the game, so...
Well, maybe one to just play on your own then. One thing we also got as well, we got the trailer for Lamb. So it was actually edited by a recent guest on the show, Tommy Malatesta. So he continues his form for creating those oddball A24 trailers. So for those who have seen the trailer, it's about a childish couple, Maria and Ivangar, and they discover a mysterious newborn on their farm in Iceland, and the unexpected prospect of a family life brings them much joy before ultimately destroying them. So it's due out in October 8th in America, so that gives me maybe hope for a London Film Festival. Dallas, what did you make of the weird trailer for The Lamb? Have you still got God Only Knows What I'd Do Without You from the Beach Boys stuck in your head after that?
Yes, I do. I'd heard the title of the film. I hadn't really heard what it was about. Following the Cannes reviews dropping, I knew that it was being bandied around with the potentially the words that every A24 fan either loves or fears elevated horror. But I think this is going to, I think it's not going to be what people are expecting. I think the trailer may be a slight bit of a misdirect as well, but I am certainly intrigued and really looking forward to seeing what happens. And yes, it does appear that the A in A24 now refers to Animal, and we have an A24 Animal cinematic universe with Black Phillip, walruses, lobsters, seagulls, all sorts of menagerie of animals for us to enjoy.
Yeah, it's such a bizarre trailer. There's some really amazing imagery in it. I think the one that really stands out for me is the one where it seems to be like this human style lamb is just like walking through the field, and the midsummer
well dressed in
style
a sort of Paddington Bear type coat and boots.
Yeah, it was just one of those things you just watch that going, I would like to see that immediately. Like, I'm just so curious about it. And I really like Noomi Rapace as an actress. It's just her career hasn't exploded the way I thought it would. I just think she's a fantastic actress. So, yeah, I'm excited to see what this one is going to be. And hopefully we get a UK release date or one that follows through at some point soon. But, yeah, a very, very interesting film. I can't wait for that one.
Yeah, I mean, that particular shot, while I appreciated it, I did wonder if it was maybe one shot too many. Up until that point, I think it is very ambiguous as to what is going on. That one, unless, you know, that, I mean, that's the thing. When you make a trailer, you can infer anything you want, you know. So, I mean, it could be a complete misdirect. It could be a dream sequence or some of that. We don't know yet. But yes, no, I mean, when I saw that trailer, I was like, I mean, oh, I'm going to watch it anyway. It's made by A24. Not made by A24, distributed by A24. But yeah, I mean, that has ramped up my expectations. And yes, I mean, I don't know. They are just, as we're speaking and recording this episode, they are kind of dropping more of the film lineup for Toronto Film Festival. Haven't seen it listed yet. They have sort of dropped films like Titan and stuff like that there, so there's a chance, yeah, I think that it could show up at one of the sort of Toronto or London potentially as well, but hopefully we won't have to wait too long for a UK release date being announced on this one. Otherwise we may have to go to the dreaded iTunes account. I mean, we didn't mention that about Green Knight. How long are you prepared to wait before you
I did the maths, and so yesterday I got a press release. So Lionsgate releases the movies of sort of A24 in America, and they sent me like a press release saying that on September 14th the DVD and Blu-ray will be released of Zola. So that makes me think that if that came like 3 weeks before Green Knight, it will probably be at the end of next month that we will have maybe the opportunity on iTunes USA to maybe rent or buy the Green Knight. So that is my maybe hope. But we saw it quite early on that like Zola, only a couple weeks after its release, was put up for rental for $20. So who knows? It's one of those things. I think it's the fact that there's no end in sight for when the Green Knight's going to be released. Is it one of those things I'm going to wait forever to watch it on some sort of streaming service? It's just, as I mentioned, Entertainment One have not officially said the film is not coming out. It's just been sort of leaked on Twitter. It's a truly bizarre set of circumstances. So I think I will pay the $20 to either buy or rent it, whatever comes first.
Because I know you waited, I think it was about a year to see Eighth Grade in the cinema. Even when, you know, that at some point didn't have a guaranteed UK release date. So yeah, I'm just intrigued to see how long he can hold out before giving in and watching it on the small screen.
Exactly. And talking about big purchases, A24 has recently explored a possible sale with an asking price of between $2.5 billion and $3 billion. Obviously, that didn't come together and the sale essentially stopped. But it was some interesting kind of news as people are talking about sort of this whole, you know, network at the moment where things like MGM have gone for $8 million, and kind of the debate about, well, how much is A24 worth? And, you know, I read a great piece in Variety where they talked with an insider, and they were like, no one ever talks about the A24 flops. They only talk about what's coming next. And I'm like, clearly never listened to this podcast. So yeah, what did you think of the news? It's not the first time we've heard about A24 potentially up for sale, but it never seems to find the right home.
Yeah, no, I was actually having this conversation with someone at Sundance about A24 and the Apple sale, and they say, I mean, but you know, they just produced, you know, hit after hit after hit, and I'm like, clearly you have not watched the films from, say, the first sort of 5 years of A24, because there was, you know, certainly a few films which we have not looked too favourably upon. And then sometimes A24 didn't even know what to do with certain films, say, like Under the Silver Lake, which is still the probably the most egregious entry in the A24 marketing campaign. It was surprising news. You know, I don't think there's any need for them to sell. I think they're doing well enough, you know, as it is. Obviously, I mean, what is interesting looking A24 compared to other movie studios and distributors at the moment is that, you know, they did wait it out. They did play the long game and waited for the ability to put their films back into cinemas rather than just dumping a load of content on streaming. Admittedly, some went slightly more sort of day-to-date, say like Saint Maud. It took forever to come out in America, but then I think it was about like a two-week sort of window there. The price, I mean, given the price that they charge for their candles, you know, I can see why they have such a high price tag. You know, something's only worth what someone is willing to pay for it, and if, you know, it was mooted that someone was willing to pay for that, then good on them. The fact that they've now done, what is it, about 110 films, and they're quoted at $3 billion, whereas MGM have done thousands and thousands in their back catalogue, and they were up $9 billion. One would say that is A24, you know, is MGM worth three A24s? I guess we'll have to see. I know that Apple were the one mooted with potentially buying them. They've obviously had a pre-existing relationship with certain films and TV shows dropping on Apple TV. Most recently, they had sort of On the Rocks was an Apple TV exclusive in America for streaming services-wise. So I can see that it's a natural fit for them. If they were to go with a streaming service, it seems like the right one. What it would mean for future A24, that is what makes me slightly worried. At the moment, they've got a lot more creative control, and I think at the moment they can afford to have the odd misfire, whereas, you know, and then make, I mean, at the moment they're not paying a huge amount of money for any sort of title. I think, what was it, Boys State was around about sort of 10 million that they got the rights for, or something like that. So, you know, they can afford to spend sort of 5-6 million at Sundance acquiring the rights for Hereditary and then making, what, $180-190 million. At the moment, they're kind of looking at the sort of Blumhouse model of sort of pay cheap, find some good marketing, make a return on that. I think the pressure that would come from a sale to to Apple or somewhere like that in order to make more commercially successful hits would then start to come in, and then I think that's where we would potentially lose some of the genius behind A24. I don't think they would be as risk-taking, and I think they would suffer for that, similar the way to a giant beer company from where I live that I personally hate but a lot of people like. You know, they started off being punks and, you know, sticking it to the man, but then, you know, when you sell 24% of your thing to a Budweiser brewery and become a billion-dollar company, it's very difficult to say that you are punk anymore. So yeah, I would worry if they did sell. I think that there's still a lot of potential for them to continue the model as what they are. But given the current situation with Green Knight in America, I would strongly urge them to at least diversify into at least opening up a UK branch and distributing their own films in the UK. Because let's face it, if something is distributed by the A24 in America, a lot of people just refer to it as an A24 film anyway, probably to the chagrin of, say, somewhere like Sony Pictures, who are releasing Zola this week in UK cinemas, but everyone's probably still referring it, even I think I did, on the red carpet, as an A24 film.
Yeah, so talking about that film, Zola, so we're, you know, it's so, it feels so rare to be diving into kind of a big A24 film. It's been a little while, but based on the infamous Twitter thread about a waitress who agrees to accompany an exotic dancer, her put-upon boyfriend, and her mysterious and domineering roommate on a road trip to Florida to seek their fortune at a high-end strip club. So starring A24 regular Riley Keown, Colman Domingo, Nicholas Braun, and Ariel Chatel. The film was originally due to be produced and directed by disaster artists James Franco, who left the project after Sexual Assault Scandal and Bravo came in. She remarked to Rolling Stone, "It felt very masculine. It was leading with its dick. Not that I don't like leading with my dick. I do. It wasn't about injecting something more feminine. It was about injecting a voice that felt young, electric and black." So Bravo shared her thoughts on taking over from James Franco at Sundance London, and here she is.
I read the story on Twitter the day it came out. Not live, I'm not on Twitter, so I wasn't a part of the live engagement, but I read it within the 24 hours that it came out. And I am a theater kid through and through, and so when I read the piece, my feeling was, if I'm going to adapt this, I want to treat it the way I would any other piece of literature, right? Which is to be as true to the text as possible, to uphold it in the way you would Chekhov or Ibsen or Shakespeare. And so to me, just because it was on Twitter, I didn't find that to be a less than medium. I wanted to treat it in the same way. The original script was leading with its dick, I'm glad you reminded me. It just was much more naughty than I was looking to make it. That is to say, in the first 20 pages, if I recall, I think there were 4 scenes of nudity. The women were naked 4 times. And I just felt like, I don't know that the audience is ready, and I refer to us as the audience, I don't know that we are ready to talk about sex work and sex trafficking when we are meeting women in the buff. I just don't know that our brains can all the way handle that. And I wanted us to walk away from the film being able to have these conversations, and also feeling like Taylor and Riley had been offered consent, right? That everything that is in the film was because of permission, even from the men who are naked in the movie. And the previous text was, I think, leaning more into the ride and more into the party, and I wanted to engage with the trauma, because when I read the text, I just felt there was so much trauma inside of it. There was a good deal of humor. That was why I felt I was right for it. If it had not had the humor, I don't know that I would have been the right director to spearhead it. But the behind the curtain of that text is quite traumatized, right? It is a survivor processing this really horrific experience.
So Dallas, we both caught this last week in London. What did you know going in about this story, and what was your initial reaction?
I mean, I knew of it. I had never read the original Twitter thread, and I still haven't actually read it. I wanted to kind of go into it, at least initially, as blind as possible, so I didn't have sort of, there's that thing where if you sort of read a story, I think you sort of create in your mind your own version of it, and therefore it's the same sort of, like, if something's been adapted from a book or whatever, I will kind of normally wait until the film is out and then maybe go back and read the source material, just so I'm not colored in my thinking about a particular story and whatever. I want to see what the filmmaker has done with that story first. So saw the trailer, made it look like a very, very wild ride. I think it's maybe slightly tamer than the trailer makes out. But in terms of sort of energy, sort of tone and plot, I think the biggest sort of reference for me was probably sort of one of the earliest sort of A24 films, sort of Spring Breakers, about, you know, you've got a group of a couple of women who go down to Florida, fall into the crowd with an unscrupulous man, hijinks ensue, and it quickly leads to bad things happening on spring break, essentially. Boop, boop. I did enjoy it. I first watched it on my phone. When it was confirmed that we were going to get the roundtable interview, I didn't want to be the guy going into the interview not having seen the film and just asking really sort of vague questions. So I'd missed the press screening, so I decided to watch it on my phone. I think it's a film which works on a phone, given the sort of subject matter and the way that the story was created. However, I think it did play very differently with an audience, and you get that sort of energy, and you can see how people react to it, particularly certain characters and stuff like that. So I think it was around about a 3-star film for me on first watch. It was creeping up probably towards a 4-star when seeing it with an audience. What about yourself?
Yeah, I was the same. I've kept myself a little bit in the dark about this film. Like, I watched the trailer. Like, I remembered reading the Twitter thread at the time, and my mind just went blank and almost became sort of like an urban legend, probably, in my head, that almost even things like Chinese Whispers, where it's been so long that probably the story's just blown up from what it originally was. And yeah, I just kind of was like, I'm not going to spoil the movie. Like, I think when you listen to interviews, they're like, we're treating this like it's like a, you know, a holy text, you know, whether it's a Stephen King book or this or that, like, we are just going to treat it seriously, and that Twitter isn't some sort of lesser form for an adaptation. So I treated it the same. I wouldn't read, you know, if, you know, my mind's gone blank on things that maybe A24 is adapted from being a book, but I wouldn't go, I'm going to read the book before the film. So I felt the same. I was like, I'm not going to read the Twitter thread. I'm going to go in relatively kind of as unknown as I can. And I just sort of knew about it as a probably sort of like a couple of strippers go down to Florida, and that's kind of what I amounted to. And as you say, sort of hijinks ensue. But I didn't kind of realize the sort of the whole sex traffic aspect of it and how that kind of comes around, and I was very surprised by that. It's one of those films where early on it moves on from it's about two strippers that are going down to Florida to make some money at a strip club. Like, I thought that was going to be it, and that film moves on very quickly in about 25-30 minutes on to something a bit more bigger and kind of a bit more surprising. And that was something I didn't expect. And I think the marketing, rightly or wrongly, keeps that up its sleeve, where you watch the trailers and adverts and you kind of get the impression that it's this kind of a bit of a like a wild ride. It's all a bit crazy. There's things going on, but it kind of keeps the sex traffic aspect a bit hushed up, and how easy it is to fall into to that world. That came as quite a surprise to me.
You know, it's just going back to the text, right? That this is the world as she presented it. While the film is not journalism, it is not documentary, my one assignment was to be true to her voice, and the women that she introduced me to, us to, she never looked at them with judgment. What she judged was the situation that she was pulled into, not the work. She had also made it really clear to me early on, because she, as a 19-year-old, was working in sex work, and she made it clear, I don't come from a fucked up background. I haven't found myself in this because my life was so hard or because I didn't have opportunity. I wanted to be in this. I was turned on by this world, and I had had a certain relationship to my body and to sex, and I wanted to play in this space. And I had not met anyone like this, definitely not on screen, who had been inside of sex work, who had that amount of agency and comfortability, right? And going back to like the Pam Grier of it all, right? Like, how can a woman stand so much in her voice and also still have a great rack? And that was kind of like the thing that she was playing with. I feel the film is also saying that trafficking is something that is happening in the United States. It's happening right next to us. It's happening, you know, it's at the house next door. It's in the car next to you on the road. Basically, like, it's sort of saying it doesn't look like this one specific thing that we've decided, right? Or like that the narrative, there's more nuance to what that world can look like and who it happens to.
It was an interesting, and I think it's that was one of the probably one of the aspects of it that attracted the right director to it, and was probably a more appropriate voice to tell that side of the story than I think James Franco as well. But I mean, I think it's also interesting to look at from even almost from a UK perspective, where when we hear sort of about sex trafficking, we on the news and stuff like that, it's normally about, you know, Eastern European women or sort of refugees being sort of, you know, promised salvation and stuff like that, a new life in the UK, and sort of smuggled over either in sort of these truck containers or by boat or stuff like that, and basically then just being held captive and by people and forced to work in the sex industry. Whereas this is a much more almost sort of subtle, insidious route into it, where just being in the wrong place in the wrong time with the wrong person, and suddenly you're submerged sort of headfirst into this really dark, disturbing world. And I think it was interesting to see that, you know, there are different avenues and traps to fall into in this kind of thing, I think.
Yeah, I was reading a thing where, you know, her, you know, we call her Zola, but her real name is Asha King. And I read an interview with her where she was like, I made people who probably wouldn't want to hear a sex trafficking story want to be part of it because it was entertaining, when she was kind of talking about her Twitter thread. And I think that's almost what Zola is, in a way that it kind of captures probably that essence. I mean, she's a producer on the film, of like, it brings people in. Like, you know, how many people go, oh, I can't wait to see the new A24 sex trafficking movie? Or, you know, it's more like, as you say, that Eastern European vibe of like, oh, it's a Taken thing, it's an action adventure sort of romp movie. You know, with something like this, it's like, oh, you've caught me. And I think that's maybe interesting, you know, whether that's been by default design or whether they've decided for a marketing purpose, let's avoid sort of sex trafficking, let's just kind of keep it like a Spring Breaker style vibe, if you're just kind of like paying half attention to maybe sort of social media or the marketing campaign.
Yeah, no, I think, yeah, it's I think if they'd led with that, then yeah, it would have been not a completely different film, because the film is what it is, but yeah, I think it would have been a completely different audience that you would have been marketing it towards. I think you would have almost been like, just let me be like another film sort of around this time, where like sort of Stillwater, a sort of gritty drama about a woman who ends up in the wrong place at the wrong time and finds herself in deep trouble or something like that. I think it would have been presented more as that kind of movie, where this is very much leading with the wild ride that you're taking, but then it also actually has a serious story to tell underneath it as well.
Yeah, so I think the highlight for me of the movie was this cast and these characters. So kind of let's go through them first with Riley Keough and Stephanie, but let's kind of hear first from the director, because you asked her about the performance and the use of her voice. So let's hear about that.
I'm a big A24 fan, and I love that they, even though you had to wait a long time, I'm really glad that they committed to putting it out in theatres and not on streaming, because I think it's great for that. Two of the performances in this film are two of my favourite performances I think I've seen this year, and I just want to get your thoughts on the sort of casting and how you directed them. One, Colman Domingo, is fast becoming one of my favourite actors. I think he's electric in this. And then Riley Keough is very, very committed to...
You picked the bad guys. The bad guys are fun.
Mm-hmm. I know, they're always more fun.
The villains are fun.
I know, yeah. But yeah, Riley Keough really commits to, essentially, I think it's been talked about in interviews and stuff, is a black voicing, where she basically takes on the character of a black woman, even though she's white. I mean, what sort of conversations did you have with her about... I mean, it's quite potentially a polarising performance. I mean, how did you talk to the two actors about bringing it all together on the big screen?
So I'll speak to Riley first, because her part is a bit more complicated. You know, she is a minstrel, and she is wearing a black scent, right? She is putting on manner and mannerisms that we have associated with black people, black women, that have not been appreciated when in those bodies. But when they've been taken on by white people, white women, there has been a good deal of pleasure. In fact, there are artists who have made money off of minstrelsy that black artists have not been able to benefit off of, right? And we got there, I don't know who the real character is that Riley plays. I don't know the real woman, I don't know the real Stephanie. And in building all four of those characters, particularly the three that I didn't have the life rights of, my co-writer and myself, Jeremy O'Harris, we kind of used little bits of things that we could find in the Twitter thread, because the Twitter thread doesn't introduce you to those characters before. It tells you who they are that weekend. It tells you who they are for 72 hours. And so we use colors from that to kind of define them. And this idea that I'd had about Stephanie's character, because Zola is 19 when she writes the story. Taylor is not 19, you probably noticed, playing the part. But I had a sense that some portion of the audience would arrive at the story struggling to get on board, struggling to believe her, because we have a hard time believing women. We really have a hard time believing black women. I'm sure you guys all read that and noticed it. And so I felt that Riley's character needed, to use sports terms, a kind of handicap. And because even with a handicap, when we meet both women, they would be starting at the same line. And so that's how we arrived at her taking on this accent, right? There's something very, like, violent about her embodiment, but it is also kind of fun, and it's dangerous. When we met, she had a sense that that's what I wanted, because some of that writing is on the page, and she said that she was worried she would be canceled, and I was like, and I am too. And my feeling was, we couldn't apologize for it. We had to run at it head first, you know, we kind of had to be like on the precipice, you know, without the net. And we got a coach to help her with her accent, help her kind of shaping that voice. And I think she did this really beautiful job, but I do feel she is embodying something that is a bit hard to pin, because if you're taking too much pleasure in her performance, you're asking yourself, is there something wrong with me? And I think that both of those things can happen. I think she can do a great job, and we can also ask ourselves, am I okay? And then Coleman, it was in the text. It's one line in the Twitter thread where there are two things that she said that I thought were super funny to me, which were, it was 24 hours before she'd heard his name. And I was like, first of all, we've all been at that thing where we've been next to someone who you didn't get their name, and you're like, fuck, have we been here for days? Who is this, right? And you like learned all these things, but you're like, I have no idea what this person is called. And that just seems so funny to me, to add to the story. And then within the 24 hours of not knowing his name, he then suddenly also got an accent, and he got really angry. And she was like, she literally is like, where the fuck are you from? And I just was like, we've got to put that in there. And he also worked with an accent coach. And so that wasn't so much invention as much as it was already in there. And it was about crafting where we could allow for this moment of magic.
So yeah, what did you make of Stephanie, Riley Keenan's kind of, I would say, even though she's not the titular character, she'd probably be our lead character.
It is an interesting one, isn't it? Because Stephanie is certainly the one that drives the narrative forward. It's her decisions are what propel the plot forward. And the character of Zola is essentially played by Taylor Page in this, is almost certainly in the movie version. I don't know, because since I haven't read the Twitter thread, I don't know what sort of honest she had in that, but it does feel like she is a passenger at times in her own story. She's been swept up in this crazy ride, and she is unable to get off the roller coaster, and it just keeps going. And Stephanie is the one that drives it forward. And I mean, Riley Keough, for me, is the current queen of A24. She's tied with Elle Fanning now for the most A24 performances for a female actor in four, tied with Robert Pattinson, the king of A24. At some point, those two are going to do a movie together, and it will be the greatest thing that A24 has ever done. I mean, I think this one feels slightly like an extension, I guess, maybe of, in terms of some of those from A24, probably American Honey is probably the closest thing she's got. But she wasn't a particularly nice character in that. But here she's truly, at times, truly repellent, but also incredibly watchable. And I think it was Bravo actually sort of said to me, oh, so it's the bad guys that you like, when I was talking about the two particular characters. And I mean, it's just, I mean, I think it's clear to see anyone who watches this movie up on screen that just the sheer amount of charisma and screen presence that Domingo and Keough have in this is undeniable. And I mean, it's clear that she is very, very committed and doing a very fearless performance in here, because it's the kind of thing which could go incredibly wrong. But I think she pitches it just right in doing this black voice performance, where essentially she's taking on certain vocal affectations, the use of certain words and phrases and mannerisms to essentially pretend that she is a black person. And yeah, it's the kind of thing which could be a complete swing and a miss. I think, yeah, because Bravo sort of says that, you know, that Keough herself was worried that she was going to be cancelled for doing this and hated on by a lot of people. But I think that she manages to pull it off to the benefit of the film.
Yeah, I felt pretty ignorant, to be honest, until after the film, until I really dived in, that I didn't kind of realise that was what the character was doing, was this sort of black impersonation or sort of leaning into that culture. you know, I don't know what that says. It says something about me, to be honest, that I suppose it's, you know, you think of Scotland, it's a very white country. And then you kind of think about America and then like the American kind of South and a very kind of a different kind of atmosphere and kind of character of individual. And I just wasn't exposed to that world. And I was just watching it going, oh, that's just what she's like, you know, kind of she's, you know, that's her vibe, really. And I didn't realize afterwards that she was essentially doing this kind of black impression. And I felt, you know, I was quite surprised by that. But I really like being able to hear from the director and go, oh, that's what that was. And when I rewatched it, you know, I got a screener copy as well. And I kind of sat down to watch it. And I was like, oh, I get what's going on now. And I just felt a bit silly, you know, really. It's just my own ignorance that I didn't realize that was what was going on. Or, you know, I was completely oblivious. And I'd be curious to know how that plays with international audiences. Like, you can imagine it being a bit more something people might click with in America or maybe like a metropolitan city like London. I wonder in like other parts of the world if they'll be aware of what they're, what's kind of going on and the deeper kind of meaning with the character.
Yeah, no, I think out of all the characters in this one, I think she'll be the one that will be the most divisive and probably create the most sort of discussion, sort of post-screening over a tasty debrief after your Cineworld Unlimited preview, which is an interesting choice, I think, for an Unlimited preview, certainly.
Yeah, I agree with you as well about Zola. Like, the two times I've watched this film, like, yeah, she is the titular kind of character, but she feels very much like that passenger. And, you know, whether you're almost meant to feel like, oh, I'm the character, you know, I'm Zola, I'm along for this ride just watching these kind of larger than life people, that she has just sort of gone down this kind of rabbit hole into bizarre boyfriends, you know, pimps, you know, crazy strippers, all these sorts of things, where it's like, how do you compete with something like that? And, you know, I think almost that kind of character, you can almost imagine falling into that world, just shutting down, just being like, be out of sight, be out of mind, don't cause any trouble, because, you know, she's surrounded by dangerous people. You know, she is essentially fallen into sex trafficking, and we, you know, that world is dark, dangerous, and not many people probably make it out alive or healthy. So I can almost see why she's so passive. You know, maybe in this, if this was a film that wasn't based on a true story, Zola would be this much more different character, maybe always looking to escape something like that. With something like this, it's probably true to life with the actress kind of involved as a producer credit. But on the other side, it could be that she kind of tempers her role of like what she actually did. You know, it's, you know, this is only her view of what happened that we are really getting by and large, apart from that brief scene. So it's one of those things, it's hard to know what's truly going on with the character of Zola.
Yeah, I know. It's like you say, there's almost this sort of fight or flight or potentially fright response. Because there's a moment where, you know, she attempts to leave and then is basically sort of then frightened and coerced to get to carry on in this journey. And, you know, she does have moments of a steeliness and a refusal to it, but she's still always clearly aware that, you know, it could go wrong. And since she's not able to do the flight response, she does essentially almost become sort of very frightened and passive, like you say. And it was one of the things which I talked to the director about on the red carpet, about how did you know that Taylor Page was going to be the right person to be able to connect with audiences and be the one to sort of take on this journey with us.
You've spoken previously at the round table about how you had a bit more creative license with the characters of, say, like X and Stephanie, because you hadn't met them. Working closely with sort of Isaiah Zola on the script and the story, when did you know that Taylor Page was the one to be able to bring this character to the big screen and also to do justice to Zola and also to be able to take the audience on what is quite an extreme story?
You know, we met over 700 girls for the part. When I got the film, one of the things that I had been kind of using in my pitch was that here was an opportunity for us to cast what would be referred to in our industry as an unknown. I think that word can be a little bit yucky, but there was an opportunity to cast someone who maybe had had less credits. And so we did this very wide search across the country, and I was scouring Facebook and Instagram and sending girls to my casting director, and they were, you know, sending in monologues. And in that period, I had been home and I saw like the end of this ad, what I thought was an ad, and I saw this girl in it. And I tried to describe her to my casting director. I was like, she's black, she thinks dances, she's pretty. Do you know who she is? And of course, that doesn't make any sense, or is 100 million people. So I think it's maybe a month before we finally get Taylor, or a few weeks before we finally get Taylor, I'm sitting at this coffee shop in LA, and she walks in, the girl from that ad, and I was like, oh my God, it's her. And so I take my phone out, I take a picture of her, she sees me take the picture, she is not okay with me doing that, because I didn't know she'd been on a television show, on this VH1 television show that I had never watched, so I guess she thought I was just like some asshole, right, taking her picture. But I send it to my casting director, my casting director goes, oh, that's Taylor Page. And I was like, yes, that's who I was telling you that I saw on television. Cut to, she comes in, she reads for it, and I just knew it was something in my gut. I mean, like I said, when I saw those 20 seconds on television, or 7 seconds, 8 seconds, whatever it was, I just, something told me it was her. And it is pretty symbiotic with how I arrived at the script too. I read the text and just kind of knew this is supposed to be the film I'm working on. And it isn't particularly scientific, it just was. And I think it's my gut.
Yeah, definitely. I think one of the characters that we've both shared a lot of love for was Coleman Domingo's ex. Much like you, he's becoming one of these actors, whenever he pops up in a role of a film, whether it's small or large, he's one of the best things in it. I completely forgot he was going to be in this movie until I watched it. What a performance from him.
Oh yeah, you know, like you say, yeah, he's been, I think it was If Beale Street Could Talk, when he played the dad in that, he was just brilliant. He was, for me, one of the highlights of Ma Rainey's Black Bottom. Even just from the trailer, the latest trailer for Candyman, he looks like he's having a blast in that as well. And I think, yeah, he's, oh, and of course we've had him in Euphoria as well, in that excellent sort of two-hander, which you can listen to on a previous episode of the 24 podcast. So yeah, no, he is destined for superstardom, I think, in my eyes. And this is one of those sort of career-making sort of, you know, but, you know, it's your proper, you know, best supporting actor, you know, in the sort of Critics Circle Awards. You know, he's going to get a lot of love for this. You know, he's slipperily, you know, he's like a snake, but he's very charismatic at times, but then, you know, he can just turn it on a dime and be threatening and dangerous and stuff like that. And it's the most entertaining performance, but also it's that bad thing of you really enjoy being in the presence of, at times, well, essentially, like, he is, you know, he's admittedly a pimp, so yeah, you shouldn't enjoy his company, but it's impossible not to. And then I guess it sort of leads into this thing of why certain people, you know, are around him and why he has the control he's got over certain people.
Yeah, definitely. I think one of my favorite characters as well, I mean, I'm currently going through Succession withdrawal symptoms as I wait for season 3, was Nicholas Braun's Derek. What did you make of this very, you know, easily entertained white boy, kind of, you know, I thought he was fantastic. I loved how pathetic his character was. And yeah, there are certainly parallels with early season 1, Greg the Egg, of Succession. But yeah, I thought Nicholas Braun was really good in this. He's just an actor I really enjoy, and has some fantastic comic timing. And, you know, just the scenes where he's like constantly calling Stephanie on his phone, like it's like 2 a.m, like, I'm thinking of going to get some dinner, would you like to wait for me, you know, or just all these things where he's like, oh, I thought we were, like, this isn't you, this isn't, you know, when there's kind of the showdown later in the film. He seemed to get a lot of the great kind of standout comedy moments.
Yeah, no, he's an actor that I'm actually completely unfamiliar with, because I have not started Succession. Probably for one of the reasons, I think it's either on Sky and I don't have a Now TV subscription, or the fact that I probably would blitz through 2 seasons really quickly and then be like you, having withdrawal symptoms, waiting for season 3. So I think maybe when season 3 is out and ready, I'll probably start my Succession rewatch. But yeah, no, he was probably the most pathetic character on paper, and I can imagine that he's probably, in real life, that person is probably the one who looks at the Twitter thread and the film and feel he's probably been the most hard done by in terms of a presentation, because you know, Bravo himself sort of talks about the fact that, you know, she worked very closely with Zola, but she hadn't really met any of the other characters involved, so there was much more of a creative license to shape and mould these slightly more sort of stereotypical characters. So, you know, I was very entertained every time he was on screen, and yes, I will need to start my Succession watch.
One of the kind of unique points of the whole film is that it is this adaptation of a Twitter thread. What did you think of how they achieved this with the sort of the sound designs and sort of Mika Levy's score? It kind of reminded me a little bit of Eighth Grade in the way with Anna Meredith, where it's like the you know, I'm terrible at describing music, but you can sort of see that there's that similar vein together where sort of like you listen to it and you can almost imagine it's the sound of the internet. That's certainly something that they're clearly both trying to kind of go for.
Yeah, no, so I don't know if you're aware of this because you weren't around on the last day, but Mika Levy actually turned up to the premiere after the film had started. She didn't see the film, she only caught the very end credits, but was brought up on stage at the end for the Q&A. Clearly not someone who's really comfortable with public speaking by the looks of it. She likes to let her music do the talking, I think it'd be fair to say. But she did manage to sort of talk a little bit about, and the most surprising thing was that at the premiere, that was the first time that Bravo and Levy had met. They had done all their interactions over email or Skype and stuff, and that kind of thing sort of blows my mind when you're making a film, that the fact that, you know, you've got two people on other sides of the world yet are able to pull together this incredibly perfect, cohesive thing at the end, that, you know, Bravo would write down that I'm looking for a score like such and such, and then Levy goes, oh, okay, I know exactly what to do, does it, and then that's it. So, yeah, using sort of certain notification noises and whatever to sort of craft certain musical elements, bringing in the sort of musical influences that the characters would have listened to. And then also, I think they talked briefly about how you've got this, I think it was called, if I remember on the subtitles or captioning for it, I think it was called like ethereal tinkling, sort of like the beginning and the bits where it sort of goes to black and then she's sort of doing her makeup in the sort of hall of mirrors scene, if you remember those sort of musical moments. So it's sort of creating this sort of fairy tale thing, and I guess like Alice in Wonderland, she goes down the rabbit hole, and not for the better in this one. And I think the most surprising thing for me in terms of like the social media aspect was the relevant lack of social media representation on screen. Certain other directors who have done movies like this would have probably thrown up lots of Instagram posts and, you know, incoming tweets sort of notifications up on the screen and been very visual with it. Here, there's just the Twitter whistle whenever there's some dialogue, which is a direct quote from the Twitter thread. That's what's used. So, yeah, I thought it was very minimal and restrained in that effect. I think it allowed the story to be told without potentially shoehorning it in as just a Twitter thread.
I fell in love with this story, and I knew that because it was born out of the internet, that the internet was also woven into it, and that the internet had to be Amit, right? There had to be these digital gestures. I also knew that I didn't want to see a person texting on a phone. I knew I didn't want to do inserts of phones because things like that just make me want to jump out of that window. So like, how I had to sort of figure out like, what are the things that most titillated me? Like what excited me? What kind of scared me that felt like a fun way to play? I'm a theater kid through and through, as I think I said at the very beginning of this. And I, as we arrived at sort of like, how do the women text each other? Or how do we text in our world? I was thinking about a theater aside and how one can treat a Shakespearean aside within a play. There can be a sea of people and a person has an aside, and we buy that it is something that's happening internally that they're inviting us into. And so I kind of took that and put it inside of here. To me, the film feels as a whole more Brechtian. I mean, it's expression. And I also was looking at it as a almost like a physical piece of art, right? Like if I were making a physical piece of art that were hanging in a gallery, it would need to be in conversation with the phone, right? Because the phone was, those characters were so tethered to their phones, and their phones were also extensions of their personalities, and that's where, like, they each have a phone ring that is, you know, supposed to be some window into their character. And the Twitter whistle was something that was written into the script, and the idea behind that was that I wanted, when we used a piece of dialogue that was in direct reference to the Twitter thread, meaning that it was pulled exactly from the thread, the whistle is meant to homage its original source and say, like, this is, you know, from our great creator. For me, the genre is stressful comedy, which is, like, my genre, right? Or I feel that is the space I'm trying to inhabit, or that's the lane I'm carving out for myself within comedy. So I think it's that genre first.
Yeah, and I liked as well, like, I think it's the bit where, like, they're taking the pictures in the strip club, and, like, it's almost turns into the whole cinema screen is, like, the camera shot where it's, like, snap black, snap black, snap black. I like those little touches as well. And in the round table, I asked her what sort of, like, influences in terms of, like, art that she drew from.
I suppose my question is, like, there's never been a film that's been drawn from, like, Twitter before. Like, what inspiration did you draw from when creating this film? Like, you can think of, like, films about journalism, they dive into certain films. Like, what inspirations did you draw from to, like, make the first Twitter movie, or was it going into the Wild West, really?
For me, most of the references I looked to were actually photographic, and the artists whose work I was sitting with primarily were Philip Lorber de Korsha has this book called Hustlers. I also looked at Deanna Lawson's photographs, and which I most reference of the photographers who I looked at and most reference her work. And then there is this Argentinian photographer whose name is Maxime Magnano, who goes by the name Suffer Rosa on Instagram. And I can speak to why each of them. I generally try to not work off of movies because I have this habit of, like, through some process of osmosis, like, kind of taking on. And so I do my best to sort of separate myself from that. And mostly I think in photographs anyways. But I did have a small list of movies that I shared with my cast and crew because they really were hungry for that. And those movies were, we talked a good deal about Pam Grier, primarily because she was, to me, a sort of emblem or symbol of a black female protagonist who was full of agency but also totally comfortable in her sex. So the film Coffee was a big reference for us. I looked at this one scene in Natural Born Killers, which I call the drug zone scene, because the usage of light in it was super radical. Paris is Burning, because of how all the ballroom scenes were shot. I love the relationship to light in those spaces. There was Law and Order Special Victims Unit, because I find it soothing. Showgirls, because it's Showgirls.
Yeah.
Because it's Showgirls. And there's probably something else I'm forgetting in there. Oh, Killing of a Chinese Bookie, Cassavetes' film, 70s, also because of light in the nightclubs just felt like a great place for us to kind of jump off of.
So yeah, so it sounds like we've kind of enjoyed Zola a bit on sort of our repeat watches, but I'm glad that A24 held out and released this one in the cinema. As you say, it's fine to watch this sort of one on a laptop by and large, but I think a film like this has to be enjoyed with an audience.
Yeah, no, I think it's all very well to watch it on your phone. I mean, it's the kind of film which is, like you say, because it's a spawn from social media, there's a certain benefit to being able to watch it on your laptop or phone. I mean, it's like you say, it's part of this new wave of social media influenced films, like, you know, A24's Eighth Grade. I think the one, I'm not sure if you've seen this one, Spree, I think it's on Netflix at the moment. It's about an Uber driver who decides to live stream a series of killings on the internet in order to become an influencer, essentially. So, I mean, there is this groundswell of, you know, this is the way that young people are telling their stories, so it seems fit that, you know, people are then sort of taking these stories and putting them on the big screen. But I think it's a film which would be greatly improved with an audience just sort of reacting to, I mean, I think, you know, it's very, very funny in places. And I think, you know, the two movies which types of movies which are always benefit from a cinematic audience are comedies and horror films. And, you know, there are some pretty shocking moments in here as well. One in particular, which got, I think, simultaneous laughs and gasps. I will not spoil what it is, but you'll know it when you see it.
The film has been this, I can only really speak to my own experience and my experience with this film. It was supposed to come out a year ago, and it did not. And that was really painful. And I spent a good deal of the last 16, 17 months mourning. And I didn't know how to do it or where there was room for me to feel bad about a movie when there was so much tragedy, especially on a scale that felt really insurmountable. The film has now been out for, I think, a month now. It's about to be a month in North America. And the amount of people who've said to me it's their first time back at the movies. And not only is it their first time back, but it feels worth it. It feels like this movie was worth it. Makes those 15, 16, 17 months feel a little less lonely and a little less sad, right? And as much as I wanted to release the film, you know, have it leave my body, you know, making a movie, probably making a TV show like this too, I just haven't had that opportunity to do that from seed to sow, but there are three or four stages that you sort of divorce yourself from. There is the, like, writing to then prep to then production to then post to then release, right? And so, like, I needed to be able to sever the film from my body. We had something sort of umbilical going, and I felt like I had been dragging this movie, and it was quite heavy, and it didn't fit through all the doors, and it kept bumping into walls, and, like, I wasn't able to take my next step. And it's not about a chapter close or an end as much as it is some kind of beginning for myself. And I feel like I am in it now because it's still coming out. You know, it's coming out in stages, and I can feel this kind of release. And what I hope the film gets to be a part of or a signifier of is that people still do want to go to the movies, right? I mean, we spent a year watching streaming. I've watched so much, more than I think I've ever watched in my life for this last year. But nothing beats sitting in a theater. You know, I got to see the Sparks Brothers film last night, and I was like, nothing beats this. Nothing is like this communal experience. And so I hope that in this purgatory that we have been in, and that I think we'll be in for another couple of years, right, this sort of unanswered territory, that we still know that people do want to go to the movies.
We'll hopefully be back shortly to discuss Val, the next film from A24. I wish we could be saying that we were off to talk about The Green Knight, but we'll be talking about...
It's still too raw. It's still too... I can't talk about it. It hurts too much.
We'll be looking at the career of Val Kilmer, and hopefully we've got some more exciting interviews on the horizon to drop as well. So thanks everyone for listening.